This Star News Media podcast is presented by North Chase Family Dentistry. Open evenings, Saturdays, and they probably take your insurance. Visit them on the web at northchasefamilydentistry.com.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, a podcast from Star News Media. I am your host, Hunter Ingram, and I'm a reporter for the Star News here in Wilmington, North Carolina. When you're not joining me on the podcast to talk about Cape Fear history, you can find my byline on coverage of the local film and television industry, my weekly TV Hunter column, and more over at starnewsonline.com. This week, we're introducing something new to Cape Fear Unearthed. As I comb through books, articles, and records while researching this podcast, I come across so many fascinating stories that I will never be able to share them all. While some are as far-reaching as the Rose Greenhow episode from earlier this season, others are quicker, more concentrated snapshots of local lore that still have implications today. And so, for this week's episode, it's just going to be us, as I introduce a new seasonal special we're calling the Cape Fear Classics. Each season, one episode will be devoted to telling three short stories that are valuable to the region's history, but might not need an entire episode to flesh out. These exciting, entertaining stories might be pure legend, inscribed in the historical record, or just perennial favorites shared from generation to generation. This week's inaugural lineup includes the story of a stoic tree that stood as a beacon of Wilmington for colonial mariners braving the treacherous waters of the Cape Fear River. Another tells of the mysterious and often talked about offshore booms known as the Seneca Guns. And finally, we'll learn the very literal and often overlooked origin story of the community now known as Monkey Junction. This week, it's a three-for-one episode of the podcast, so settle in as we share Volume 1 of the Cape Fear Classics. Chapter 1, Pouring One Out for the Old Dram Tree. Hundreds of years ago, the Cape Fear River more than earned its name. Today, sonar technology, radio communication, and nautical advancements make traveling along the famed river a much safer practice, allowing shippers to bring goods into Wilmington and sightseers to enjoy the beauty of the region without worrying what might lurk under the water that could impede their journey. But when seafaring was a dominant mode of transportation, the choppy, murky, and downright treacherous waters of the Cape Fear struck just that in captains and crews. The name of the river is said to have originated in 1855, when Sir Richard Grenville dubbed the waterway the Cape of Fear because of the unease it mustered in him and his crew as they maneuvered around and through its bends. John White, governor of the Roanoke colony, also shared a similar unease about the waterway a few years later. Most of that fear was solely focused on the shallow waters and sneaky sandbars of Frying Pan Shoals at the mouth of the river, on which ships did not want to get stuck. But through word of mouth and cartography, which put the name Cape Fear River on maps of the New World, the river's name and reputation persisted even as word spread that caution was the best practice. As more and more ships traveled the river as the colonies grew, the lingering fear of getting bogged down in the Cape Fear became part of the trip. For the 20 or so miles of winding river between modern-day Southport and Wilmington, crews were on high alert for any signs of shifting sounds and depths. But when they rounded the final bend before what would become downtown Wilmington, a single sight is said to have sent a wave of relief over the vigilant crew. Jutting out from the shore was a bald, ancient cypress tree, crooked and contorted by hundreds of years of storms. Draped in gray moss and noted by its solitary station, it stood as a guard of Wilmington's harbor. As soon as the tree came into sight, crews knew they had survived the uncertainty of the Cape Fear's waters. Local historian James Sprunt described it as such, quote, "Like a grim sentinel, it stands to warn the outgoing mariner that his voyage has begun and to welcome the incoming storm-tossed sailor into the quiet harbor beyond," end quote. To celebrate, many ships would join in toasting the tree with a dram of rum or whiskey, a tradition that eventually gave the welcome pillar of Wilmington its name, the Dram Tree. It was so well known, it is said to have been part of the tour given to President William Howard Taft when he visited the area in 1909. But as Wilmington's status as a port grew, it would give way to a careless end to the tree's life. The city's burgeoning business of World War II shipbuilding meant increased dredging efforts were conducted. It was during one of those efforts that the tree was destroyed sometime in the 1940s. By the time locals realized it was even in jeopardy, it was too late. Still, its legacy as a staple of colonial Wilmington and the era's maritime travelers remains. It is even the subject of a few legends tossed around in history books and tours. Lewis T. Moore notes two such tales in his book, Stories Old and New of the Cape Fear Region. The most thrilling and surprisingly romantic of the two calls upon the age of piracy and the reputation of Stede Bonnet, the pirate we spoke about in our Money Island episode. If you recall, Bonnet had sailed with Blackbeard at one point and was eventually captured near Southport before being taken to Charleston and hanged. Before all of that, however, Moore's story goes that Bonnet traveled the Cape Fear River on occasion to replenish his supplies, be they procured through stealing or legal means. It was on one such journey that he anchored his boat north of Wilmington and visited the plantation of a former crewman who had left the pirate's life behind for a law-abiding existence. He had married a Wilmington resident's daughter and made a happy life for himself. Still, he welcomed Bonnet and his men as a gesture of goodwill to his former associate. But the man had business a few hours away, so he left the crew to reap the hospitality of his home, with a promise that he would return later in the day. During that time, Bonnet, drunken on the wine of his host, gave in to his more nefarious impulses and decided to abduct his former friend's wife. Fearful of incurring their boss's notorious wrath, his men put up little resistance. And so they fled with the woman to their ship and set course for the mouth of the river. Once the sails were up, Bonnet gave the woman free rein of the decks, the colonial equivalent of a flight attendant telling you you may roam about the cabin. As Bonnet and his men prepared for the voyage ahead in those legendary Cape Fear waters, they gave little mind to the woman, who used that leniency to slip away and jump overboard into the river. But she was no fool. She didn't just jump into any part of the river. She plotted her escape within swimming distance of the legendary Dram Tree, knowing full well that she could take refuge on its small but secure base. There, she waited through the night, clinging to the trunk of the tree, hoping her husband would follow in pursuit of her captors. And indeed he did. The next morning, after the sun rose, she noticed his ship on the horizon. Pulling her aboard, the couple was reunited, and the husband was understandably furious by the betrayal of his former friend. Moore postulates that Bonnet likely shrugged off the loss of his prisoner, knowing he had wronged his former friend and never to return to the plantation, at least not to history's knowledge. Moore's second story involving the Dram Tree also tells of it acting as a refuge in a moment of desperation. This story finds a British officer in the early months of the Revolutionary War struggling with his duty to protect the Crown's controlling grip on the colonies. Complicating his allegiance to the British Army was his close relationship with his brother, who had sailed to the colonies years before and made a life in the Cape Fear region. His brother's supportive stance on a rebellion softened the soldier's own sympathies for the colonist, and he had expressed such doubts to his fellow soldiers before, casting doubt on his loyalty. One afternoon in the fall of 1775, the soldier's ship sailed into the Cape Fear River, planting a rebellious idea in his mind. The next day, the ship set course to again return to the mouth of the river. And after nightfall, the soldier quietly slipped into the water and swam towards the dram tree, a marker he had made note of on the journey in. Before long, his absence was recognized on board, and reports of his wavering duty from his fellow soldiers were called upon as reason to sound the alarms. A soldier had gone AWOL, but the choppy waters and cover of night had given him a head start, as it wasn't until the next day that search parties were sent out to hunt him down. As boats scoured the coastline, he clung to the tree and hid among its branches, just as the woman had done more than a century before. If more stories are to be believed, he managed to evade capture, and his former ship eventually gave up the search and sailed away, likely believing he had drowned in the night. The soldier made his way to Wilmington and volunteered to stand alongside the colonists in their fight for freedom, a defection his brother vouched for. Moore says the man told the story of his escape to the townspeople, and even managed to live through the Revolutionary War, after which he settled in Wilmington for good. If that tale is true, it was under the branches of the old dram tree that a patriot and a future Wilmington resident found shelter. Today, the tree's legacy has survived, even if it hasn't. In 1988, the city opened Dram Tree Park at the base of the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge. It's a riverfront green space that offers a boat ramp for safe passage into the river. An artful 23-foot sculpted replica was commissioned as an homage to the original dram tree that, for several centuries, stood as a comforting, stoic welcome to anyone sailing into Wilmington's embrace. Chapter 2, The Mystery of the Seneca Guns. We've all heard things go bump in the night. But have you ever heard or felt something go boom in the distance? More than a few people in the region can offer up stories of such experiences, thanks to a perplexing phenomenon that has inspired wild theories and a search for answers for more than a century. The story goes that the sounds come out of nowhere, and they're described as unusual claps of thunder or distant cannon fire. They've been heard and felt up and down the state's coast, and they go by a few names: the Seneca Guns, the Seneca Booms, and Skyquakes. Although the sound of a far-off boom doesn't seem all that threatening, the lack of explanation has long since fascinated locals, and even sent a chill of unease down the spine of those who have encountered them. In 2001, more than 100 people reported the noises to the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office, telling operators the sounds were strong enough to rattle their windows and shake their homes. The most recent widespread event came in April 2014, when the National Weather Service assured residents the sonic boom they had felt miles inland was not an earthquake. In 2005, one of the booms was even felt by the cast and crew on the set of the locally filmed series One Tree Hill in downtown Wilmington. The sounds always occur during the day, usually in the spring or fall, have yet to cause injury, and are never heard on the water at the time of the event, only by those on land. They aren't exclusive to the Carolina coast, but stories often center on the Tar Heel State shores and just south near Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The name Seneca Guns can be traced back to a short story written in 1850 by James Fenimore Cooper called The Lake Gun, which references the booms as they were heard on Lake Seneca in New York State. But what really causes these quakes of sound? At this point, your guess is as good as any. And to say that theories posed over the years vary wildly would be an understatement. Conservative naturalistic explanations range from landslides or gaseous explosions on the ocean floor to shifting tectonic plates beneath it. Such natural occurrences or seismic disturbances seem reasonable enough, considering we know very little of what happens under the sea. But curiously, the Seneca Gun events have never been picked up on seismic meters, something that would happen were they the result of tectonic activity. Some scientists have eliminated earthquakes and grinding tectonic plates because the nearest plate boundaries are hundreds of miles away, and such sound events wouldn't even originate in the depths of the ocean, but in the atmosphere above it. Others claim the booms are the powerful aftermath of military jets breaking the sound barrier while doing tests off the coast, something no military branch record has ever corresponded with. Skeptics of that theory will also claim that reports of the booms, especially those in other places in the country, predate the invention of planes, let alone sound barrier breaking jets. But more enticing, if not fantastical, theories begin to emerge when you consider explanations that require you divorce yourself from reason. Could it be UFOs zooming off the coast, like some question? Or what about the claim that the boom is the result of a crack forming in the space-time continuum, or a fracture opening between this dimension and another? One theory, jokingly or not, suggests it's the reverberating sound of gunfire exchanged between pirates on the high seas, echoing from a time long past. Perhaps the most well-worn legend even suggests it's the ghost of Native Americans making a ruckus to disturb or try and scare off the descendants of the white men and women who forcibly claimed their land after arriving in the New World. Like I said, no theory is spared when it comes to trying to explain the booms. Reports of the Seneca guns became so widespread that the U.S. Geological Survey created a webpage debunking the rumors that circulated around the phenomena. Among the causes they ruled out were tidal waves, lightning, meteors crashing into the atmosphere, methane gas being released on the ocean floor, landslides off the continental shelf, sinkholes forming under the sea, cold air colliding with warm Gulf Stream air, a hole ripping in the ozone, and even Chernobyl-level disasters being hidden from the public. In fairness to all those theories, the Geological Survey doesn't completely rule all of them out. It just strongly advocates for more reasonable answers. In the early 2000s, Duke University professor Peter Malin sought to find answers by lowering a seismograph 1,389 feet below the ground at Fort Fisher, an effort he hoped would better gauge vibrations and disturbances in the earth and possibly register an explanation the next time the Seneca guns were heard. He told the Star News at the time that he thought the guns were likely an atmospheric event. Unfortunately, funding for the $20,000+ project never came through, and it was never completed. So with what we have, what are we to make of the mysterious Seneca guns? Maybe it's best not to know. The most likely explanation is a natural occurrence we have yet to fully understand. But with so much of our history given finite conclusions and explanations, could this be one of the rare moments when we don't get the comfort of an answer? The Seneca guns have delighted and shaken residents of this coast and others for decades. And there doesn't seem to be a rhyme to their occurrence. So maybe there doesn't need to be a reason either. The next time they rattle the Cape Fear coast, bask in the unknown, speculate wildly that it's the work of earthquakes, aliens, or ghosts, and appreciate one of life's great mysteries happening right outside your door. Chapter 3, Monkeying Around. What's in a name? It's a question that's been asked of many a community that has adopted an eyebrow-raising name sometime in their history. Just in North Carolina, peculiar town names include Bat Cave in Henderson County, Lizard Lick and Fuquay Arena in Wake County, and the one word, why not, in Randolph County. Because why not? In this region, the community name most likely to draw questions from those passing it is Monkey Junction. The area surrounding the now heavily trafficked intersection of Carolina Beach Road and South College Road. Today, most of the traffic headed to Carolina Beach is concentrated through Monkey Junction. The noteworthy name of the unincorporated area has become a badge of honor for those who live in its vicinity. But how exactly did it get such a title? The answer is actually quite simple. In the late 1930s, in the years after the Great Depression, roadways to Carolina Beach and Fort Fisher weren't as plentiful as they are today. Essentially, there were two roads near the current site of the intersection. Carolina Beach Road, which snaked up from downtown Wilmington and curved toward the beach, and Piner Road, which met it at that curve. At this junction, Dina and Jack Spindle built a gas station, believing it would serve the beach-going travelers, especially as the military ramped up more operations at Fort Fisher. If you remember from our Fort Fisher Hermit episode, the military took over the historic Civil War site as a training facility for Camp Davis in the lead-up to World War II. At their store, the Spindles wanted to make sure people had a reason to fuel up and fill up on snacks and essentials for their journey to the beach. But they didn't want to just leave it up to chance that people would stop. So they did what any person would do in their situation. They bought a monkey. Of course, this is an unorthodox promotional tool. But in time, it worked. Beside the store, they built a cage to house the monkey, which soon became monkeys. They had large and small monkeys, which passerbys would stop to see and feed with peanuts they bought in the store. At this point, the monkeys weren't just an attraction. They were helping turn a profit for the Spindles. But with the good, so too came the bad. The couple also had to deal with the natural behaviors of monkeys. Ed Letendry, the nephew of the Spindles, told the Star News in 2007 that as more soldiers passed by the store, the more trouble his aunt and uncle encountered with the monkeys. As a joke, the soldiers would give the monkeys beer bottles and other things to play with, some of which the hot-tempered primates would throw back. After a few too many incidents, the roadside attraction was done away with, and the monkeys were sent off to appropriate new homes. But the area's reputation as a monkey junction stuck around. When the North Carolina Department of Transportation began shoring up and expanding the roadways, it dubbed the area Myrtle Grove because of the nearby sound of the same name. But the residents and frequent tourists of the area weren't about to abandon the legacy they had grown accustomed to. It was Monkey Junction to them, and it still is today. The monkeys may be gone, but their staple as an early entry point to the beach is not unlike the role the dram tree played for mariners on the Cape Fear River. For those headed to Carolina Beach and Fort Fisher in the 1930s and 40s, the sight of that Monkey Junction meant they were on their way. That's it for this week's episode of Cape Fear Unearthed and the first installment in the Cape Fear Classics. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode that will take us back to our regular format as we explore another tale from the history books. Be sure to share your thoughts on this week's episode on Twitter with the hashtag CFUnearthed, or you can email me your thoughts at capefearunearthed@gmail.com. As you listen to this season, I also encourage you to join our Facebook group, where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their thoughts on the region's history. In that group, I will be posting extra content like pictures pertaining to each week's episode and more as our season progresses. This week, I'll be sharing a ton of photos of the dram tree as it stood for hundreds of years. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. Finally, you can get a list of all the books, articles, and resources used in researching this podcast in the show notes of each episode. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, Hunter Ingram. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com. Additional editing is done by Adam Fish, and this episode was recorded at WHQR Studios in downtown Wilmington, which has been gracious enough to host us this season. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Until next week, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. What you learn might just surprise you.